The Talk of the Northwest, The Greg Hughes Show on Highland Radio.
Hello and a very good morning to you. 4 minutes past nine for Wednesday, the 4th of March, 26. How are you all keeping? Do hope you're very well indeed. We're all feeling good in the office here today, which is nice, isn't it? And we're all set for another busy 2 hours of The Greg Hughes Show here on your number one local radio station. In fact, your number one any radio station in the Northwest, Highland Radio. We've got plenty to talk about. Lots and lots of you having your say on fuel prices, oil prices, and the fact that they've shot up, even though much of this product is in the country already. But there's two sides to every story, and I've been contacted by quite a few people in the industry that are saying that things aren't quite how Micheál Martin has portrayed them. If you didn't hear yesterday, Micheál Martin said that there's no excuse for the price rises in fuel over the last couple of days, he says, because the majority of our fuel comes from the North Sea. And he says, you know, there's gouging going on if prices are shooting up. But we all know, don't we, the price of petrol, diesel and home heating oil particularly has gone up. And home heating oil. The majority of our home heating oil is refined in County Cork. Whether you knew that or not, I don't know. And much of it is imported from Norway. And Norway doesn't source its oil, per se, from the Middle East. So people are wondering, right, I presume we've got oil in the country. We've got oil that's already been delivered to Cork. It's still being refined. It's still sitting in tankers. How can this home heating oil all of a sudden jump 100 to 300 euro? The same could be said at the petrol stations. Much of this petrol, this diesel, is already in tanks under the forecourts or in tanks somewhere else in this country. But apparently it's more complex than that. There is a system whereby these companies factor in replacement costs, right? And then it gets kind of complicated for me anyway. Maybe it's simple for you. But then they factor in replacement costs because they look at what's happening into the future. It still is peculiar as to how you can justify the profits that you would be making on the stuff you already have, when you'll always have you'll also have profit margin factored into the stuff that you're going to buy into the future. But apparently in the industry, this is a standard way of doing it. But what hurts, you see, we know how quickly these prices go up to insulate these companies, and then we also know how slow they are to come down. And apparently, why are they slow to come down? Well, because they need to see stability in the market before they'll drop those prices down. And that's why they go up quick and come down slow. That's a brief overview from what I can determine. But all I know is that many of us are struggling. Many of us are quite literally living Friday to Friday, Thursday to Thursday, or end of month to end of month. And, you know, lots of people are looking at home heating oil and going, I can't afford that now. I can't afford that now. So all the talk is just noise. It's just conversation. If you have anything to say in relation to any of that, please give us a text, give us a call. Our text number is 086 60 25000. Our phone number is 07491 25000. As always, you can watch the program. We stream it on YouTube. That means you can watch it on your mobile devices, but also on your smart TV or your Fire Stick, which suits a lot of people, especially those in other countries where they might be home for the evening or not heading out to work. They actually stuck us on, which is, it's lovely to have you guys on board as well. And we're across Facebook and on the X platform. So I'll get to the Middle East and the impact it's having on fuel prices and all that type of stuff in a moment. But I want to start with the Finn Valley Voice, and it's Seachtain na Gaeilge. And but Donegal's Gaeltacht areas, including those served from Dúchuí to Broca, are not getting the Garda service they need. So says Mr. James Cherty, retired Garda Sergeant, a member of the Joint Policing Committee. This is the Finn Valley Voice, if I didn't mention. Sergeant Cherty is on record as opposing the closure of rural Garda Station and other policing changes introduced over the past 5 years. He said, the reality is that life in rural Ireland is diminishing, with banks and post offices closing, and Garda Síochána is going the same direction. People have lost contact with local Garda Stations. So on to the Nationals now, and I presume you've consumed as much coverage as you might want to of what's happening in the Middle East. And our attentions are obviously very much focused on those that are over there, either transiting through the big airports in that area or perhaps we're on holidays over there and are stranded. And you might say, oh, what a place to be stranded. Yeah, but people have to get home and money runs out and all that type of stuff. And I was talking yesterday about where are these repatriation flights from the Irish government. These airports are active to some extent, but certainly airports are in that region are active. And there didn't seem to be a plan, you might remember me mentioning yesterday morning, there didn't seem to be a plan from the Irish government as to how people might get home. Well, today's a little bit different, apparently. The government will charter flights to airlift Irish citizens stranded in the Gulf in the wake of Donald Trump's airstrikes in Iran, with the most vulnerable prioritised to travel home first. Foreign Affairs Minister Helen McEntee last night said about 2,000 Irish people were actively trying to get out of the region, and the first flight out would only be able to take about 280 of them. The flight will evacuate Irish citizens from the United Arab Emirates via neighbouring Oman, which I think I've referred to as Omar in the last couple of days for some reason. The first charter flight will be targeted at Irish citizens currently in the UAE, particularly those who are non-resident and who are vulnerable and require assistance most urgently, Ms. McEntee said. She said the evacuation flight hoped to take off within days and is expected to be the first of many that would be needed, with around 24,000 Irish people now believed to be in the Gulf region. Many of those, the majority of those who live and work there will wish to stay to ride this out. Like anything that begins, it will end. The open-ended part of this is, when will it end? But the truth is, as resilient as Iran might believe it is or try and portray, this bombardment from Israel and the US cannot continue indefinitely or open-ended, because the level of activity in those skies is astonishing. So back to the effects at home. It's the front of the Irish Independent, and these are the prices. And the impact of the Middle East conflict on Irish consumers has been immediate, with home heating oil prices soaring and motor fuel also climbing. The price of home heating oil has sparked particular concern, with the cost rising by about 40% since last Friday. The increase has prompted the government to open a Competition and Consumer Protection Commission investigation. The average cost of 500 litres of oil was €4.98 5 days ago, but jumped close to €700 by yesterday evening, with many companies pricing it even higher, representing an increase of close to 40%. Plus also, too, the companies are sort of saying how you can deal with them. There's a cap on how much you can buy, and you must buy you must phone in person, you can't order online. You know, there's a few bits and bobs that are going on. But anyway, I'll read on here. The price of 500 litres of oil with Dublin-based provider Butterfly was €7.03, with Serta Oil charging £6.99. And on it goes. We know what our own prices are up here again, and we'll try and get to the bottom of this for you. The government believes, through Micheál Martin, that there is gouging going on. A lot of this product is actually the crude oil still in the country. It hasn't even been refined yet. Why are prices going up so quick? 086 60 25,000. Interesting story in the Irish Daily Mail. The family of a woman who died in hospital from COVID-19 pursued a high court claim for damages in her memory. In the first court case relating to alleged medical negligence leading to a COVID death, legal papers said grandmother Elizabeth Betty Carroll, 61, from Mayfield County, Cork City, had been diagnosed with blood cancer and was vulnerable to catching the virus. But neither she nor her family were advised of this immunosuppression and her vulnerability, it was said. It was claimed she had been exposed to an avoidable risk of infection with repeated transfers between the Mercy University Hospital Cork and nursing home step-down facility St Francis Unit on Baker Street, Gurranbraith, Cork. This is interesting because at that time, one of the greatest concerns that I was expressing on this programme, because I was seeing what was happening in Italy and was happening in other countries, was that we were seemingly, and I'm not talking about any particular facility here, just to be careful, but we were seemingly saying to people who didn't need acute care but may have had COVID that they would be moved to nursing homes, effectively transporting the COVID from the acute hospitals around the country into nursing homes where people were very, very vulnerable. And at that time live, I was like, this doesn't seem like a practical thing to be doing, because I was looking at the images from Italy, where people were, particularly older people, were very susceptible and the bodies quite literally were piling up. It'll be interesting to see if this is a one-off case. It seems like a case that I've heard a lot, to be honest with you. So this will either be the catalyst for many or a one-off case we shall watch on. Just an update on where we're at in terms of purchasing vapes. Shops will no longer be able to advertise the sale of vapes under new laws passed by Cabinet. So this is a new development carried in the Sun. Companies will also be banned from using bright colours and flavours to flog e-cigs to kids. The lack of flavouring going to be a big game changer, you know, for future vapers. Those who are addicted will have their own challenges in getting off them. Shops and websites will also be banned from selling nicotine pouches to under 18s after these addictive products have become popular with teenagers. The government yesterday signed off on the Public Health Tobacco Products and Nicotine Inhaling Products Amendment Bill 2026, which will introduce a range of new measures to clamp down on the sale of vapes and other products to kids. Now, I would say there are kids. I'm not going to be too happy about that. But I think we as a society should be pleased if children are having less unfettered access to vapes, especially those that are designed quite literally just to get them addicted to a product. And lastly, in the Star today, laughs erupted in an Oireachtas committee room after the Gardaí said they do not actively monitor the dark web. Appearing before the Artificial Intelligence Committee yesterday, Assistant Commissioner Angela Wills said, while Angada Síochána have the expertise to monitor the dark web, they don't. This is despite Fianna Fáil's Nessa O'Carroll pointing out there is a high prevalence of child sex abuse material on the dark web. Asked why they don't, the Assistant Commissioner of Organised and Serious Crime said, I suppose it's down to capacity. It's as simple as that, and our capacity to monitor it. However, she did clarify that if a complaint is made about illegal material on the dark web, Gardaí will investigate. And I would say they get information from other countries that might be more active in that space and might find accounts that are in this country that are accessing the dark web, which I don't really know what it is. To be honest with you, I'm not really that interested either. But apparently it's sections of the website that are separate to what normal people be on. Right, that's all the information I have on that. Okay, I'm joined in studio now by the new president of Letterkenny Chamber, Caroline Sweeney. Thank you very much for joining us and congratulations.
Thank you very much, Greg, and delighted to be here.
And people will know, of course, that you're also the managing partner at Castle Grove Country House Hotel in Letterkenny. Tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, I suppose.
Okay, Greg. Well, I spent a lot of time in the United States. I was in New York for about 17 years after I graduated from college. And I did work in hospitality. I started off basically waiting tables. And I was there, you know, after college, just for the idea was to be there for 1 year. Ended up staying, long story short, staying for 17. Worked hard, worked my way up to managing partner of two restaurants within the one restaurant group. And then when I finished that chapter and decided that I would come home for a little break just to see mum and dad and the family, and I decided to stay at home basically then, short story, to help at Castle Grove and see what I can do and contribute to the business there, and obviously get to spend some time at home with my family, as I've been away for a long time.
Yeah, for sure, and it sounds great. And a lot of it is in a certain area, right? So where in God's name does the bachelor's degree in physiology and anatomy fit in all of this?
Well, it doesn't, I suppose, really, but it was just something I wanted to do when I left secondary school. And then after achieving my degree, I decided I wanted to travel. I'd always wanted to travel. So I went to New York, and New York's a great city. It's a great time. And then I left there after a year and travelled all around Asia. And then when I came back, I went back to New York for a little while, and I just was doing very well over there and really enjoying it. So at the time, maybe much to my parents' dismay, but I really just enjoyed it and I learned so much, and maybe I was always meant to be in hospitality and found my way home.
Yeah, for sure. Is there one thing or two things that you learned in New York that you were able to implement over here? I don't know in terms of how the business is run or how you deal with customers or, I mean, obviously, listen, you've gathered all of this expertise and you know how to deal with people to run a good ship, right? And how to engage with your clientele, your customers. But is there anything in particular that you sort of were able to implement?
Well, I definitely learned a lot in New York for sure. I mean, I learned a lot from my mum because we were all working in the family business before we went away. But when I went to America, I learned a lot. I think the main thing I learned for sure is to just to work very hard. Mm. If you want something, you just have to put in the effort. Hospitality is hard work. It's very rewarding. You're dealing with the people all the time. I think you have to be very calm and patient. But most of all, I think the most important thing I have learned, if you really want something, you have to put your mind to it, work hard and keep going. And, you know, it's all about the guest experience with us at Castle Grove. It really is. It's about the details and it's just about taking the time to get everything right and put in the effort, really, I suppose, is the best thing I could say.
And I suppose if you are getting that right, and in fact you are, the sort of commendation, the recognition externally comes with that eventually,
Correct. Doesn't it?
And the business has been very highly recognised in that regard.
The business has done very well. I mean, Mum and Dad started the business in 1989, and from the get-go she was receiving accolades and awards right out the door. And like I said there a few moments ago, I mean, we've learned so much. My mum came from hospitality background as well. So we had the grassroots for sure. And then we moved to a dairy farm. So we worked in a dairy farm as well throughout sort of secondary school growing up. And that was hard work too. But it was a great upbringing because we learned how to work hard, how to value things, how to appreciate things. And if, you know, to the understanding that if you need something, you really have to put in the effort and go for it. And I think, you know, the respect for people around you that you're working with as well is really important. And just to add, and you know, you mentioned about the hotel doing really well, and it is doing really well. I mean, the hotel itself and the restaurant is doing very well. The food is exceptional, Castle Grove. But we're surrounded by a wonderful team, some of whom have been there between 20 and 30 years. And obviously the younger generation who come along are super excited. They're very energised, they're enthused, and they all just do a fantastic job. And it's unique in its sense that still today we're a traditional family-run country house hotel, and that's our core, very much so, and that goes across from the staff right through to the family. Yeah. And it's just really nice. It's a nice place to work. It's a lovely environment, and I think the guests see that and appreciate that, mm-hmm. and that filters across to them.
Well, I mean, theoretically, you could just busy yourself with what's up the lane and say we're doing well, we've got a good reputation, you know, where can we go from here? But you are very interested in, you know, the tourism sector as a whole, the food sector, sustainability, the success of the region, not just your own business or your own area. Why so? Because, as I say, you could very successfully just focus solely on what you're doing.
Totally. I suppose when I came back from New York, we got involved in the Donegal Food Coast. And now I'm currently, recently last year, we took the Food Coast away. So it's a member-led, originally it was run by a local enterprise office, which is still very much supported by that, and Fáilte Ireland, Údaráis and Donegal County Council. However, now we've created a non-profit CLG and it's member-led and member-driven. And I'm also a member of the Donegal Associate Committee. I'm just very passionate about Donegal. I love food. I love to see businesses do well. I love to see producers do well. And I just, I'm really, really connected to that. And I love Donegal. I love tourism. I love Letterkenny. I love what I do. And I think if you are in hospitality, you have to love what you do. Mm-hmm. It's a lifestyle. It's not a 9-to-5.
No.
It's very much.
And I think too, whilst obviously if someone dines with you, for an example, you know, obviously how something looks and how it tastes is very important. But people like the story too. People like to know where it's coming from. People like to sort of get a sense that it's local as well, particularly visitors to the area.
Very much so. And that's very much the way at the moment, which is brilliant, because we want to eat real food. Mm. Our food, our health is so important. And if the food is local, obviously it's going to be fresher. It's going to taste better. It's going to be better for you. And it takes a lot of effort and work to grow food, make food. And it's really important, I think, that we support our local producers.
And that's not always the commercially wise thing to do
either. Sometimes it's not, but I firmly believe it's worth paying a little bit extra. Mm. and always through Castlegrove, down through the years, regardless of the ups and downs in the economy and the different times, we're very proud that we've actually stuck to that. And some of our producers are delivering to us for 20, 30 years, and we still work with them. Even though they are a little bit more expensive per unit item, we believe, firmly believe, that the quality is more important.
Yeah. What, with all your experience, both acquired and ongoing, what do you hope or what do you feel you can bring to the Letterkenny Chamber as its president? I know you're an active member anyway, but particularly as its president.
Well, for me, I want to continue just the work that's going on, really, Greg. Mm. I mean, we've gone from strength to strength. I know you're very aware of what's happening in the chamber. And obviously Jimmy just stepped down last night and he's done a fantastic job, and the presidents before him, since I've been on the board particularly, I'm more familiar with them. But we are going from strength to strength, and I chaired the membership committee. So for me, it's definitely about engaging with that membership, continuing to support the small businesses. And I suppose as a small business owner, I fully understand the challenges that we face on a day-to-day basis. And I really just want to engage with the members, enhance member engagement, and continue to work with these really super vibrant and ambitious businesses that we have here in Letterkenny and the wider community. And just to continue on the good work, really, I suppose.
Yeah, because like in anything in business, there's a short, a medium and a long term. And of course, the short term stuff might be, you know, talking about traffic disruptions. Mm-hmm. The medium and long-term stuff is very important too, because the Chamber has positioned itself as a very important voice to government, if you know what I mean. So in other words, we can think about what the story tomorrow or next Thursday, but we also need to be thinking what 2030, 2040,
absolutely,
2050.
Yeah.
And in business or as a collection of businesses, that has to be the strategy as well. And the Chamber has sort of got that seat at the table whereby you can express these views directly to those that are making the decisions.
Absolutely, and I totally agree with you, and I think that's really important. The Chamber represents 337 members, and that's approximately 15,000 employees, and it's so important, and they've worked really hard to get at those tables, and now the Chamber does sit at those tables and work with the various stakeholders here in Letterkenny and the wider county, and it's really important that we get that opportunity to speak to the local council, to be involved with the ATU, to be involved in all of these different projects that are happening, and to have a voice, really to have a voice for our members, both locally and on a national platform. And we hope to go to the Dáil actually in a couple of months now. Hopefully April is our next visit. And I think that you're absolutely right in everything you're saying. Of course, there's the small things, the day-to-day things, where if we hear, there's going to be road closures or different things, that we're able to speak on behalf of our members and ultimately update them as well on what's happening and to be prepared for that. But more importantly, it's the bigger stuff for sure. And that is the main role of the Chamber, to lobby and voice that on a national level.
Yeah.
And that's what we are. And I just, all I hope to do is to continue to deliver that message and speak for our members. Yeah. And on that note, Greg, if any members do have any issues or concerns or anything that they want to tell us or anything they need help with, that they just need to reach out to myself or Tony or anybody on the board. And we have a very much an open door policy, and that's what we're here for.
OK, brilliant stuff. Unless there's anything you wish to add.
I want to just say two things. I want to thank everybody for the lovely messages last night. The support has been really overwhelming. And I also want to thank especially my own family for their support in this role and supporting me. It's really, really appreciated, and also supporting me in the fact that I'm going to have to take some time out of my business. So I just want to say thank you to everybody. It's been really overwhelming, the support so far.
You say that. Will you actually take time out of your business or just work a bit harder?
Well, probably a little bit of both, but I'll still have to take the time out.
No, I understand, of course, to make the meetings and all that.
Exactly.
Then down to Dublin or wherever you have to go and represent. I was going to say the businesses, but really I think it's actually the region as well, because, you know, if you campaign or lobby on an issue generally, it's beneficial to the ATU, it's beneficial to the surrounding areas. You know what I mean? It's not just businesses in and of itself.
It's totally for the whole Northwest region, and the Chamber is very important and has an important role to play in that. Mm. So it's very important that we're there and we're at the tables and we get the opportunity to speak on behalf of our members.
Congratulations, Caroline Sweeney, the new President of Letterkenny Chamber, and of course, the very busy managing partner at the Castlegrove Country House Hotel Letterkenny. And it's a one-year term, isn't it?
Correct.
Okay, excellent
stuff.
Congratulations again.
Thank you,
Greg. I'm sure we'll be speaking over the next 52 weeks. Now, of course, if there are gaps or issues in the relating to the health service that needs to be covered, we do that here. But we always recognise there's a great deal of very, very good work that is ongoing, and the majority of people do have a positive experience engaging with the health service. And it's also important to highlight when we are making good advances. And I think we're in that space now because over €35 million in funding has been announced for projects in Donegal. This is under the HSE's capital plan for 2026. And to tease this out with me is Dermot Monaghan, who is Integrated Healthcare Area Manager for Donegal. Dermot, thank you very much for your time today.
No problem. Good morning, Greg, and to your listeners across Donegal and the wider diaspora for Donegal.
Right, OK, so there's a mixture going on here in terms of, I presume some of this capital spending is to finish off effectively or continue projects. I'll start with the top two here. Because the replacement and extension of the community nursing unit, 110 beds, and development of a medical rehabilitation facility, that work is well advanced. And of course, it's pleasing to see that money is being allocated for the progression of the new surgical hub, which is seen as so critical.
Absolutely, two key projects for us. People who are driving up the Kilmacrenan Road will know and see what it looks like in terms of progress. Our plan is to have the handover to, complete in around the summertime. Then that will allow us to commission the beds, and that's not a simple process. We have to get the equipping done, but also the recruitment of the staff has commenced as well. So we're in a fairly positive process there. It'll bring 50 long-term care beds, 50 short-term care beds, including 25 for medical rehab, and also 10 dementia beds. And will be a significant investment for the area and will enhance services for people. Also, you mentioned the surgical hub and the ambulatory care centre. Yes, we're very positive about that because the tender process for the design team is underway, and we expect the design team to be appointed in early end of March, early April, which will be again very positive news for us because it will bring the surgical hub and the ambulatory care centre into the visibility of people as they see it starting to go up.
There's a lot of money, or a lot of projects at least, that are listed for, you know, enhancement or upgrade at Letterkenny University Hospital. And people's experiencing there, including a pathway to the extension of the ED, but other stuff as well.
Yes, and what we've come to recognise the importance of the health planner process that's going on at the present moment. It'll be complete very shortly, and then we'll be moving towards the development control plan, which will be looking at all facets of that. So if you take the site itself, so if you say we're going to put an ambulatory cancer care centre in it, we're going to put a surgical hub, we're going to put 72 beds onto that there. We're also the ED extension, and you know, those are very significant capital developments and will make a very, very big impact for people of Donegal. But they will require support services because you can't put 72 beds onto a site and just say that's it. What's currently there is going to have to cope with that there. So that's why the importance of the development control plan is very key in this, because it will allow us to plan the expansion so that we have, if we have the 72 beds, we have the ambulatory care centre, plus also we have the surgical hub, we will need additional infrastructure to help those services function, and that's part of the development control plan. So it's not just about those three projects, there's a hell of a lot more involved around it as well, Greg.
At one point or other, I would say pretty much everyone listening to this show has had to attend the ED with what might be classed as a minor injury. And that, you know, they should be there because there's nowhere else to go, but it can sort of delay everything for everybody. What's going to happen in terms of progressing a Letterkenny injury unit, and how will this funding announcement for 26 progress that, and what might the time frame be? And how important do you see it as maybe a release valve for the ED?
Absolutely. Look, it's demonstrated across Ireland, but also across the world, the importance of minor injuries, or local injuries units, as they're now called, because what they do is they divert people away from the ED with minor injuries that don't necessarily need you to attend a full-blown ED service. So they're absolutely crucial. I see them as key to helping us manage the future needs of the population, because if we can divert people away, it means that the people that need ED services are appropriately going to ED, but other people are getting in to see their services in the locality. So we are looking to have, you know, the design process kicked off around getting the minor injuries unit designed and ready to go for us to actually put in place to help alleviate the problems there. So it's absolutely crucial service for us to get in place as well.
I want to mention some other areas as well. Falkara refurbishment of community nursing unit, the same in Buncrana. Renovation of existing building for a new ambulance base in Buncrana, new primary care centre for Lifford, Remelton Community Nursing Unit refurbishment for HICWA compliance, which is critical. The same could be said for St Joseph's Hospital Stranoller in Lifford, a new community nursing unit, Killy Gordon, purchase and refurbishment of disability services, a residential dwelling to support decongregation and community living, Carndonna, new build on HSC on site for residential dwelling to support decongregation, and on it goes, right? So this is quite a list. So could you explain to us what that means in terms of, is this a lot about sort of planning, setting the groundwork? This is all not going to be achieved in 26, and it's all not going to be done for 36 million. So for those people in those areas, and indeed Letterkenny, for some of what we've been talking about, what does this allocation actually mean in the context of delivery?
In the context of delivery, you're absolutely right, because the nuance in is that we're going through design stage, tender stage, then construction stage. So the allocation for this year deals with where each individual project is at. So, for instance, you mentioned there the Carndonna projects. Some of them are still at design and tender stage. So they would be ones that you'd be seeing work done this year, but actual construction will start next year. Some of it, we've already done the design stage and the tender, and we'll be starting construction this year. So there's a number of those projects that will have long-term investments over the next 2 to 3 years. So the 35 million is the start. That's what we're going to spend this year to get those projects. Some of them will be, you mentioned Falkara, you mentioned others, that are going to come online that will complete this year. So we expect to have, you know, a significant number of the long stay beds opened. You mentioned Joseph's, you mentioned Falkara, Remelton will be other ones. Donegal Town will be ones that will actually complete this year, but there's others that will actually go to construction next year, end of this year, early next year. But it will be a significant investment ongoing for the next 2 to 3 years.
Is this investment in property for decongregation and community living? It's a two-part question. A, is this new? Because I haven't really seen the terminology before. And B, what does it actually mean in terms of delivery?
Yeah, well, it's not new, because in some of the areas we've been trying to get decongregation over the line for the past 3 years. So if you take Carndonna, for instance, HICWA expected us to have that decongregation completed by last December. Unfortunately, we weren't able to source and secure the properties that was necessary to do that. So what we're doing now is giving commitment to HICWA that there's another process underway that we will look to get that fast-tracked and get those projects underway this year, so we can then have a completion date of late next year. What it means for the people is that the people who are currently in congregated settings, which is more than the people living in a residence of more than six people, they become into individual units of houses that are more suited to, you know, home living, provide them with the self-advocacy, the opportunity to live in their own home, To do what they want to do with their lives, to go out and visit the local communities, but that they are tailored around their needs and also in the sense of where do they want to live, where do people want to live. And that was what we're doing at the present moment with the decongregation programme across Donegal.
Now, we know Letterkenny University Hospital continues to be under pressure. We're still receiving press releases from the HSE asking people to not attend unless they have to, because, you know, there are people need to be discharged to actually let people in into beds. There's no silver bullet solution to that, but I presume as this stuff comes online, this is part of the solution to the pressure on an acute hospital.
Yeah, absolutely, Greg. And people will be aware that there's been a number of closures across Donegal, and it was as high as 93 late last year. So there was 93 less beds available in Donegal than there was at the start of the year last year. So those beds are slowly but surely coming back online. So we've had in January, we had January and February with 9 beds coming back online. We have another 5 or 6 coming back online this month to early next month, and we have a remaining amount throughout the year. There's some beds like the refurbishment of Buncrana, which is 19 bed closure, will be till the end of next year before we get that complete. But absolutely, the closure of the beds had an impact on it, on University Hospital, Letterkenny University Hospital, but also in the home support. I know we've talked about that previously, but we have progress made the last couple of months in getting approvals to bring additional home support hours back on stream, and at the moment we're currently working on that.
Because so are they funded, people, Dermot? Because as you would know, we have access to those details now, and often it can be, you know, over 300 people waiting for additional hours or a home package to begin with. Is the funding there for that, and what needs to be done to start chipping away at that figure?
Yeah, the funding is assured. There's 110,000 extra hours for Donegal this year. That is currently going through the service planning process, but we have already kicked off the recruitment process for that. So there was interviews held January, February. I think this week or next week, there's 50 people being interviewed for the home care and home support posts. Like, we're, you know, people retire, people leave, so we have a constant churn of people there. But yeah, absolutely, the funding for 110,000 hours will be there this year going in, and it's my intention to hit that target as early as possible during the year.
And
so
is
we
all
can
of
give
that
people
care
a choice.
Sorry, I beg your pardon. Is all of that care provided within the HSE, i.e. you're employing staff to provide the home care through the HSE? Because we know in other regions, of course, there's more of a reliance on private providers.
Yes. Yeah, and the model in Donegal has been 85-90% HSE delivered and 10% private. We're very open to working in partnership with the private companies. We actually met with the private 10 of the private companies available in the area in the last 2 months to check to see what is it that we could do to enhance the availability for ours there. And we're working with them to try and come up with solutions on it. Mm. It's not an easy fix, and there are areas of Donegal where it's very hard to recruit for ourselves as much as anybody else. But we are looking at every opportunity to see is there availability of ours with the private companies.
Is there a sweet spot between public-private delivery in terms of percentages?
There is where you have the
companies to do it, yeah.
So if you're in the East Coast, yeah, it's probably 60-40 private versus HSE. Other areas will be 50-50. Other areas will be, like ourselves, we're probably sitting out there as a very unique area in the terms of the model. Yeah, it's majoritively HSE. But again, we are working with, just to reassure listeners, that we are working with the private companies to see what capacity they can actually expand to and how we can help them do that. And those will be ongoing, because we do realise that, you know, the responsiveness of the HSE can sometimes be slower than it can be for the private companies.
Mm, okay. Anything you want to add, Dermot, just before we wrap it up?
No, I think it's important to recognise the positives, but it's also very important to recognise the commitment, the drive and the support that our staff give to the people of Donegal. And it's very good to be talking about a good news story, Greg, to the listeners about the investment in Donegal. And we intend to make sure that keeps going. We keep going, delivering that there, identify what the development needs are for Donegal and deliver on that there for the people of Donegal.
No problem. And as I've said to you in the past, Dermot, the lines, our line is always open to get positive information out there as well. We don't by choice trade on negativity. Thanks, Dermot. Look after yourself. Dermot Monaghan, who's Integrated Healthcare Area Manager for Donegal. I recognise as you listen to that, some of you are saying, yeah, but what about this and what about that? And we talk about that extensively on this programme. And I know myself from own family and personal experiences that there's an awful lot yet for us to get right. But that being said, when there are positive advancements, we have to highlight those too, and we wish to highlight them too. And we'll keep track of that. We'll keep track of that to see how progress is made. Because ultimately, what we all want is a better health service, not just in the acute hospital setting, but in terms of the home, in terms of in the community, and that you can access the best care closest to you when you need it. That minor injuries hub, you know yourself, the stitches, the have I twisted my ankle or is it broke? All that kind of stuff. That kind of facility would be massive, I think, in avoiding the ED. So we'll keep a watching brief to see how those things progress. I know it's early enough in the year, but as soon as we sort of get spells of bright weather at this time of year, everyone starts looking at the garden or what they could do in the garden. I wonder, has the rush started yet for people who've pulled that cord on the strimmer and it snapped, or the lawnmower won't start? Do you know that stuff we're supposed to do at the end of the season and leave them with our competent repair guy or girl and get stuff maintained and looked after? We don't do that, do we? We push it into the space where it sits and leave it lying there with the grass stuck all over the place, then start it in the spring as soon as the sun comes out and it's light after six and we realise it's banjaxed. And then we wonder why we can't get our lawnmower or trimmer fixed in the space of an hour so we can do the lawn on a Saturday and we're dropping it in on a Friday. I think it happens every year. I'm sure it does. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe we've changed, but I would say that's the way it's at. Today, though, mostly cloudy, though a few sunny breaks will develop. It'll be dry apart from a little patchy drizzle. This evening, rain and drizzle will develop near the west coast. Temperatures 9 to 11 degrees. Right. I would say safely there wasn't a house in the northwest yesterday that had more than one person in it that was not talking about the price of oil, petrol or diesel. I really cannot believe, if you're listening and the conversation didn't come up in your house and there's a couple of you in the house, I'd be flabbergasted. Greg, it's time the government grew a set of you-know-whats and tell the old companies and electricity companies that enough is enough. People have been ripped off all the time. Then they have a field day when a war in the Middle East happens. There's plenty of oil in stock. Time they started to give litres back free to people. They've made plenty of profit off people. Another good morning, Greg. Regarding the oil prices, last Friday, my oil company were advertising 200 litres of kerosene for €230. By Monday, 200 litres was €250. Yesterday, 200 litres, €285. And yesterday, my neighbour paid €385 for 300 litres. Yet, when I phoned yesterday, I was charged €500 for 350 litres. I telephoned and immediately afterwards, the website to purchase online was taken down. I'm not sure exactly what's going on in all of that. There's a lot of information to digest. I think the more oil you buy, it probably is cheaper, marginally cheaper. It's good to see that Micheál Martin says that he believes price gouging is ongoing, but what does he intend to do about it? I know what he'll do. Absolutely nothing. We all know that. Another caller says, I'm sick listening about people stuck in the Middle East. It's a deflection from the poor state of Donegal, just as Trump started this war to deflect from his part in the Epstein scandal. Well, listen, we talk and continue to talk extensively about our own county and our own region. But how, like, this is affecting us right now. There are people who literally cannot get oil anymore because it's too expensive, and it's because what's happening in the Middle East. So we cannot cover our eyes and go la 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 and hope international affairs don't affect us. Worst geese in Remelton of heating oil up to 140.9 at the pumps. Last week it was 99.9. Monday, 112.9. They have a huge depot there. Why would Pat the Cope want more foreign boats in Irish waters while our boats are tied up? The European and Norwegian boats are hoovering up all the sprat and our fish stocks are very low as it is. I didn't hear those comments from Pat the Cope, so I'd have to have a look at that. I ordered oil 3 weeks ago for 485. It must be for 500 litres. Yesterday, they quoted me 700 euro. That amount of an increase is a disgrace. Shocker, businesses on this island using any chance they get to rip us off as usual. Hi, Greg. Does Iran have the right to defend itself? I don't hear it ever mentioned. Iran is defending itself. And it's not just defending itself against its oppressors. It's defending itself against people who were in the past really friendly to it. They're firing missiles left, right, and to the centre. On the issue of price gouging, it's been going on with electricity and insurance for years. The government have done nothing about it. We got an energy credit which added to the energy company's profits. The state owns 97% of Electric Ireland. Is it that high? But they say they could put the prices down if they wanted to. I'm not sure that's quite the ownership model. I'm open to correction and will correct myself when I check that. Now we're joined by Barbara Ehahil, who's the Corda Hall Planala Changa Linra Electric Canine. Good morning to you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Majin Wai, Greg. Majin Wai.
Now, Seachtain na Gaeilge. It's the Irish language and cultural festival celebrated from the 1st to the 17th of March each year. So we're right in the heart of it and it culminates on our National Saints Day.
Yes, indeed. And it is a wonderful celebration and a great opportunity for people to just get into the habit of speaking more Irish. And that really is our theme for this year. Getting people speaking the language on a daily basis and not just for Seachtain na Gaeilge, but every day for the rest of their lives.
It's not just in Ireland either, by the way, is it? Seachtain na Gaeilge reaches people with an interest in Irish or Irish people right around the world.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And I think that tells you something about how the Irish are viewed and the way that people fall in love with the language. They hear it either often actually through music, through song, and they get interested and, yeah, they fall in love with it. So Seachtain na Gaeilge is a global phenomenon, to be honest.
And ironically, Irish that have emigrated are probably, in a way, sometimes more embracing of these things because it gives them a closer sense of home than we might be situated here. Not exclusively, but at times.
No, yeah, I think that is true. But I think it's very clear that there's an increasing interest in the language and an increasing positive energy about it that we certainly find around Letterkenny, but nationally as well.
It's an interesting little project that's ongoing here as well because, I mean, obviously you can use Irish every day but not be fluent in Irish. And we have a census coming up on May 2027. And, you know, what we're talking about now and the conversation that's happening elsewhere has the potential to perhaps, you know, have an impact on that census. Tell us more.
Yeah, so we have a campaign, as I say, launched in Seachtain na Gaeilge, but it is ongoing. And it's Bí i do Ghaol, Lord, get the Gaelic at an lán. So what we're asking people to do is to form the habit of speaking Irish every single day. So, for example, we're saying, if you're in a shop, you don't need to say thank you. You can say Gur Maigat, and people know what you mean. Even if they don't have a lot of Irish, they know what you mean. So you can do that. You can just form that habit that every day you're speaking Irish, you know, saying to people, Kajimara Tatu, Slán Leat, those small things. And that has the effect. We talk about spreading Irish like spreading wildflower seeds. And they spring up and they flourish and they spread and they create more and they change the landscape. And that's what we're trying to do with the Irish language. Because when you hear Irish, you're more inclined then to have a go yourself. So you'll find that people around you begin to use a bit more Irish. People will respond to you in Irish. Your confidence will start to grow. You get used to the sound of your own voice speaking Irish. You begin to remember more. You begin to have more of an interest in learning more. So it has just this beautiful, growing, blooming effect. But what we're hoping is that whenever we come to the next census, which, as you say, is in May of next year, people will be able to say, in all honesty, on that form, might not be fluent, but I speak Irish every day. every day.
Not insignificant. Of course, hard to believe, but here we go. It's nearly St. Patrick's Day, which is amazing. We're 13 days out. And I know you've joined up with Letterkenny Chamber to try and encourage local businesses to celebrate, however they see creatively, Seachtain na Gaeilge as part of the St. Patrick's Day Festival.
Yes, absolutely. So we have a competition, Mashing the Fuinneoga, so decorate the windows. And we have supplied to those businesses that have signed up a handbook full of phrases and proverbs and everything that they would need, that they could use to decorate the windows. And we will be going around, a couple of judges will be going around the businesses just towards the end of next week. And there is a plaque and there is a 200 euro voucher, shop LK voucher from the Chamber of Commerce to encourage the businesses. Now, I have been into about 50 businesses with information about this. The numbers who are signing up are gradually increasing, but we really do want all the businesses around the town to take this on and just to enjoy using some Irish, decorating the windows. If they need more bits and pieces translated, give us a shout.
And one more quick word on bilingual branding and marketing too, because obviously we're talking about, you know, effectively what could be marketing on St. Patrick's Day, but why not embrace that and incorporate that all year round? So what is the tie-in with Donegal Enterprise Week and what's going on there?
Okay, so as part of Donegal Enterprise Week, the local enterprise office is working with us to sponsor a seminar that's happening today, 12:30 until 2 o'clock in number 9 Market Square, Carnoug and Warragie, where we will have two excellent speakers talking about the impact that Irish has on branding and marketing, because the research is there that people are very positively disposed towards Irish language branding and marketing, that there is a buzz, there is an energy. And even if you ask businesses around the town that have their bilingual signage up or that offer some service in Irish, and they'll tell you that just the positivity that they encounter and the fact that people will come in, particularly the cafes, people will come in specifically because they have Irish language signage.
There you go.
So it really, it's lovely to be involved in something which is so full of positive energy.
Barbara, always a pleasure to have you on the programme. Thank you very much indeed for joining us. Gura Mahagat.
Gura Mila Mahagatheen.
Salam. That's Barbara Ehatl, Corder Hall Planala Changa Linra Letcher Kenine there with, and you know, an awful lot of conversation and texts we get in are about, you know, the threat to Irish culture, the fact that, you know, Ireland will become a minority or the Irish in their own country and stuff. And listen, I'm not poo-pooing on people who hold that point of view, but yet here we are, and it often is forgotten, talking about celebrating our culture, actively being encouraged to do so. So hopefully those people that tie up tricolours on posts and they hang tatty looking with pure disrespect for the tricolour, there's a few of them around Carrigart, they're just dangling there in bits. It doesn't seem very patriotic to me. They're absolutely disgraceful the way they're left to lie. And I think whoever's responsible for putting them up should probably actually tidy them up, because that's to see our flag dangling by a corner wrapped around a lamppost. That to me is not patriotism or celebrating the flag at all. It's disrespectful, I would argue. But anyway, my point being, here we are actively saying we're in Ireland. Let's use the language. Let's celebrate the language. Let's celebrate the culture and the music. Let's make sure our windows are festooned with the language. Fly the flags high. Use both Irish and English in your business if you can. You know, that's the other side of it that often gets forgotten, that we are always actively proud of and promoting our culture. Here's one from an oil lorry driver. I can assure the public that if they're making profit, the oil companies, they are not sharing it with their staff. Petrol and diesel is 20% more expensive than stations in Letterkenny. We're all in Donegal. What is the justification? There can be massive differences in the price of petrol and diesel dependent on where you are. Often close to the border is helpful. The further west you go, sometimes you can really pay a premium for that petrol and diesel. Letterkenny, there's quite a bit of competition there now, which is great to see. So you can shop around and save some money. But sometimes geographically dependent where you are there's almost like a 10-20 cent premium for just being where you are. A caller says, what about the electricity bills? Pity the government don't say anything about it. Another, most of the increases are government taxes. Yeah, but I mean, if petrol and diesel and home heating oil go up 20 cents, that's not government taxes. But the government tax on the entire, so the government takes in more money. The government takes in more money, the more expensive petrol, diesel and home heating oil is. So you are right, but they haven't applied this increase, but they get a bigger percentage of it when there's more of it. Greg, I've made an active decision to refuse to buy anything extra in the shops that I buy my fuel from. I no longer buy my breakfast, lunch or coffee in any shop who ran to rip us off. Let them enjoy their short-term gain, but we as shoppers have the power to stop them. A couple of messages on Castle Grove. Hi, Greg. Castle Grove's a fantastic place. Mary Sweeney's a fab lady. Our family love it. That comes in from Kathleen Stevenson in Remelton. I've never been there, to be honest with you, but I've heard great things. Morning, Greg. I don't think I've ever been to the Castle Grove. Morning, Greg. I've photographed numerous weddings and events at Castle Grove, and I have to say it's fantastic. The staff are lovely. The venue's stunning, and food is simply amazing. Best of luck to all the gang. That's in from Stevie. Stevie Toy, whose eagle eye spotted, I believe, his picture in the back of my podcast. But Steve, let me assure you that I made a donation, because I know you did donate that. I didn't just lift it. I want to use the public toilets in Donegal Town this week, and they were closed. They recently got a huge refurbishment. I've spoken to others who also say they're closed more often than not. Does anyone know why? We've got straight in contact with the council as soon as we receive that information to try and find out what's going on there. Let me see. There was a couple here that sort of offset, that were from businesses that gave a different insight. I'll come to those. A couple of things I want to mention, though. Now, there's a Rotary quiz night on tonight at 9 p.m. It's an Arena 7 Letterkenny. It's to benefit the Rotary Polio Plus and the Irish Motor Neuron Disease Association. Teams of four, €20 entry. So if you like your quizzes, get along. There's one on tonight from 9 p.m. at Arena 7 in Letterkenny, and you will be supporting Rotary Polio Plus and the Irish Motor Neuron Disease Association. Would it be possible to do a birthday request for my sister, Julie Jordan, in Remelton for today? Of course it is. It's from her sister, Jacqueline, and niece, Tabitha, in England, just to send her lots of love on her birthday and thank her for all the love, support, hard work and care she gives to us and to so many others at home. One of the kindest souls you could ever meet. So a very special, by the sounds of it, a very special birthday to you, Julie Jordan in Remelton. Happy birthday from all of us as well, but particularly your sister Jacqueline and your niece Tabitha, who emailed us from England to make sure that we mentioned that for you. Right, just a final mention before the break. Illy Celtic Football Club is hosting a life-saving skills demonstration. Could you help save a life in emergency? Well, there'll be CPR techniques, correct use of a defib, delivery. This all delivered by Buncrana First Responders. And it all takes place at Illy's Community Centre on Thursday, the 5th of March, between 8 and 10 p.m. The session is open to everybody in the community. No experience is necessary, because they'll give you all the experience you need. All are welcome. We never know when we might need to jump in to help someone. Do you really know how to do CPR the modern way? What's the right thing to do? What's the wrong thing to do? Defibs, they help you. They give you verbal instructions. But to have the power to know what to do to assist with their usage, you can get all that information. The Buncrana First Responders are an excellent group of people, and they'll be in the Illies Community Centre Thursday, tomorrow night, between 8 and 10 p.m. Get along. Caller says, Greg's optimistically talking about 2050. That ignores nuclear wars, climate change, rising temperatures and seas, the collapse of bees and other pollinators, to name but a few reasons. Humans are doomed. Well, even the most pessimistic, removing the nuclear war. I mean, listen, nuclear war, if we went down that route, the whole idea people have nuclear weapons is deterrence, right? So if Russia fires nuclear weapons at America and then France fires nuclear weapons at Russia and then Russia targets London, I mean, that's end game. I mean, so you need, it's literally end game, right? So the whole idea of the nuclear weapons is a deterrent. I'm not being naive, but you just hope they don't use them. The rest of the stuff you talked about, we can't, it might sound strange because we talk a lot of serious stuff on this show, but we can't spend our life worrying either. We have to live our lives and live our lives in the moment. And I don't think climate change is necessarily going to doom us by 2050. You know, the worst case scenario, it would be hundreds of years away, obviously. But I take your point, but, you know, you have to compartmentalize, right? So I get all the news I need on this show. I don't watch the news at night. At that stage, I want to relax. I want to get ready for bed. I don't need it 9 o'clock pounding into my head all the negativity, because life goes on. And also, too, you know, you won't get good news stories. We try and do good news stories here too, by the way. But you won't get good news stories that lead the news or that are on in the papers, because they don't sell. Right, so they don't sell. So you're always going to get this sense that things are always sort of worse than they are. Is there any word of the bus to Galway being updated from 3 days a week? It's a fantastic service and badly needed. Friday's the busiest day for our service patients in Galway. Can our local councillors or TDs do something about that? I think you checked that out, Caroline. You checked that with Paddy Rooney before. Could you sketch down what his answer was? I can't remember off the top of my head. Let me see. Right, I still don't have the comments from people who actually sell petrol and diesel. I emailed them to Shannon, but I really do want them. I think the sick patient should be allowed to take their pets into hospital with them, especially dementia patients. I have a parent in the hospital at the minute with dementia, and all he wants is his wee dog. We've tried videos, but it's not making any difference. It would really aid recovery. And I hear you, and I understand exactly where you're coming from, but oftentimes it's difficult to get a human into a hospital. Right, Wellness Wednesday now. It's our regular occasional feature on a Wednesday. And we're in studio with Laura Brady from Mount Charles, who is going to be abseiling from the roof of Croke Park's Hogan Stand. And it's part of a charity challenge in aid of Rare Ireland on March 8th. Rare Ireland is a national charity dedicated to supporting the families of children living with rare conditions. And Laura's abseiled over to us here in Letterkenny. Thanks so much for joining us, Laura.
Thank you very much. The whole way from Donegal Town. Hopefully it's that easy on Sunday.
It was the passport control. No?
Oh, stop.
And you've been driven to take part in this by your own life experience, and it's through your son, Jason.
Yes.
So tell us about his situation.
Jason is 10 years old. When he was born, we thought he was born perfect. There was no issues. It was just when he didn't meet his milestones. So up until a year and a half, he was perfect, smiling, babbling, the usual. But I just noticed he was slow to walk. So in the meantime, from zero up until a year and a half, he was in and out of hospital. Any infection he got, he just couldn't fight it. Mm. Now, I did obviously air my concerns to the paediatrician, but at the time they just said, oh, he's a normal child, he'll be fine. So then fast forward at a year and a half, I just wasn't happy. And no matter how many times I give out to the paediatrician, they weren't listening. So I actually brought a friend with me back then. I wasn't as strong then as what I am now. Mm. And she basically said, look, just give this woman help, please. So anyway, then he got referred to Temple Street Children's Hospital. So fast forward then, about another 6 months, we were seen by a neurologist in Dublin. And the first thing I said to him was, look, I'm sorry if we're wasting your time. I just feel like there's a problem with my child. And in fairness to him, the first thing he said back to me is, well, you don't get sent to Temple Street Children's Hospital for nothing. So straight away, as a parent, it was such a relief to think that somebody is finally listening to me.
Isn't that ironic that that's a relief?
Oh, God.
Because
and then,
you knew, didn't you? You got
you just have a gut feeling, even though he looks perfect. And even now, if you seen him, if he was sitting down, you would think there's nothing wrong with him. So basically, Jason has a thing called hereditary spastic paraplegia. And he's one of six in the whole world, Greg. So it's a bit of a nightmare trying to get information about it or find help or find families. But I'm going to get away from that and just tell you he was totally misdiagnosed for 5 whole years.
He was 7, was he?
Yeah, when he finally got diagnosed. So when he got to in Temple Street, they did loads of bloods for different things and nothing came back. So they give him a clinical diagnosis of ataxia. And then we went on there to Ataxia Foundation Ireland and met wonderful people. But I just knew that Jason wasn't the same or hadn't got the same condition as them. And then we actually in the end up paid private. So it cost nearly €6,000.
Like, you talk about eventually getting a diagnosis. If you hadn't been so determined and followed your gut so strongly, it makes you wonder where you'd be at now.
We still would have, they would have just said he has that diagnosis and that would have been it. And Greg, I don't mean to give out about hospitals. I'm sure you know yourself. Look, sometimes they're great and they do help, but 6 months Jason ended up having viral meningitis and they saved his life, thank God. But there is an awful lot of wrongdoings too. Like I was told by a doctor that came from Dublin that he would not live and that he would not walk or talk and that he would be dead by the time he was 10 years old. And that was them with a total different diagnosis, Greg, not even the right one.
These are all details and trauma that you have to process, whether it turns out to be true or not. Being told that, that takes a bit of you.
Greg, I am not joking. Yeah, I was going to people's funerals and I was crying my eyes out picturing Barry and my son. So if coming on air, even if doctors were a bit more accountable to what they are telling parents, like back then it was a scary time. We didn't know what we were dealing with. Yeah. And when you have a doctor that's meant to be a great doctor coming from Dublin telling us that your son's not going to make it. Like they were a tough few years.
Well, that's a fact. You take that as a fact.
Yeah. Oh, you believe it. Like no more than, look, doctors are very good in one way, but also just even if they're accountable to parents, to think about it, would you like that to be told to you as a parent? Do you know what I mean?
I don't know how I deal with it. And it's as I say, the emotional scarring does not fade because it's not the right diagnosis either. You feel that.
No.
You've seen the worst. And some of the best, I presume, of the health system in this journey. What age is Jason now?
So he's just turned 10 now.
Okay. How does spastic paraplegia affect him?
Yeah. So basically how it affects him now is if he was sitting down, he just looks like me or you, an ordinary child. But it's just basically when he goes to walk, he would be very wobbly. So he might look like a person with cerebral palsy or that. So he would struggle with steps or ramps. But once he has your hand, he's fine. He can walk. Now, for long distances, we have a wheelchair, which is another hard blow for a parent. Like, I'm not going to lie. It was in our house for about a year before we even could take it out and use it. And we probably should be using it more, to be honest. We use it for the likes of holidays or long distances. So
but
that's
a
sore
one.
It's
good for him to use. Is it bone or muscle that's affected?
So it's his muscles. So basically, I think it's a signal going to his brain that's not coming down the right way. So upper body, he would have unbelievable strength. So it's from his core down, he would be very weak.
Right. And how will this affect him through his life?
So unfortunately, it's incurable. So it's a lifelong condition. So basically, the cruelty in his disease is as he grows taller, it makes it harder for him to walk.
Do you allow yourself to think about advances in terms of exoskeletons and things like that?
Well, 100%. Like we've tried different things. We've
not
gone
now,
to swim lab in Lanzarote and they try to strengthen you up and they put him in a wee robotic man. So the robot was moving for him and he was walking. So I'm sure down the line, maybe things in advance will help.
I would think, easy for me to say, but you would hope in by the time 20, 25, 30, you know, that hopefully we've made these advances with AI, but you have to live in the here and now, right? Often when we speak to people, even on rare diseases, there's 30 or 40 families affected, even in the country, right?
Yeah.
And they get involved in groups and they converse and they can share experiences and, you know, they say, oh, talk to us because anything you're experiencing, we've experienced.
Yes.
You're in a unique position. He's one of 6 people in the world that we know of, right?
So
is that where Rare Diseases Ireland has come into play for you? A, in terms of, you know, fighting for the diagnosis, but B, in terms of the commonality in support is other people with children with rare diseases, even if they're different.
Well, I'll be honest. So obviously as a parent getting a rare disease, the first thing you do is go to Dr. Google, which I would advise people not to do. Mm. It's a horrible doctor because more often than often it tells you the bad stories instead of the good stories. So for us, I Googled Rare Ireland. It came up with Rare Ireland and I went to a conference a few years years ago. And that's how I met the community of other parents with rare diseases, children with disease. And then the following year, I spoke at the conference, and that's actually where we met the geneticist, the guy who changed Jason's life and who got us the correct diagnosis. Mm. It's just annoying to think, Greg, in this day and age, that you have to pay private to get a diagnosis for your child. Like, what about all the people out there that can't afford it, or the people out there that still have the wrong diagnosis?
All the people out there who went undiagnosed, caught meningitis.
Imagine,
and
it's
we never know.
That's what I'm saying. You will never know.
You just simply don't know. And that's concerning.
In fairness to Rare Ireland, so basically what they do is they help families throughout all of Ireland, not just in Donegal. And they would like provide genetic counselling. They would provide therapies. They pay for the likes of physical therapy, OT, equine therapy, a lot of stuff. So they do help. Like,
just back to the thing I've observed from sitting in this chair and in my private life as well, is that sometimes you get a sense, whether it's true or not, that I naively thought that if there was something wrong with you, that they kept going and kept going and kept going till they found out what it was. Sometimes it feels now that they give up.
Greg,
so they've exhausted the obvious, and then
they leave you lying
for years.
Lying
there.
Like, they'll still do, and I'm not giving out about doctors, because thank God a few of them have had to save his life a few times, because with his condition, like, he's been in hospital, say.
Well, we're kind of more on diagnostics here,
okay,
really, than
40
care,
or 50
yeah.
time. Okay, but on diagnostics, 100%, yeah. I agree with you.
And then what
happens
is one consultant doesn't want to step on another consultant's toes. Yeah. So in other
words, else, in our case, Greg, what happens is one consultant will back up another consultant.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, and they'll both agree on that diagnosis. Mm. So then you're left years again wondering.
And sometimes then you take your details and say, right, I'm going to go private.
Yes.
And sometimes they might say, well, such and such a person, if he doesn't know the answer or she doesn't know the answer, we're not going to get to the bottom of it. Mm. It's just, you can feel very isolated, and you can sometimes feel like you've been given up on.
Yeah.
So in other words, I'm sure there's times where you sat there and go, is Jason's life not important?
Oh,
because I feel no one believes that he's important. He's too complicated. We'll just say it's that and move on next.
Yeah, you've hit the nail on the head there, because 100%, sure, they were happy to sit for 5 years, and only before we went private, we would have still had the wrong diagnosis. So just for parents out there, Greg, that is querying it, that are afraid to stand up for their child or afraid to speak out, if you think your child has the wrong diagnosis, you are your child's voice. You are their advocate. So do annoy the doctors. I know you feel like you're annoying them, but what I've learned over the years, the more you annoy them, the more you will get the answers you're looking for.
The squeakiest wheel gets going, isn't that what you say? Right, so for whatever reason, there's loads of ways you could have supported Rare Diseases Ireland, right? You've decided to abseil off Croke Park. Now, I think it's a fantastic thing, and it sounds like it's going to be a great experience. So
I'll take your word for it, Greg.
Yeah, well, listen, I haven't done it, but I know people have. I know Brendan Devaney's done it in the past and others. But anyway, so you've got tied into this. Are you fundraising? Is this sort of
basically
we sponsor you to do this, right?
So
you put yourself at peril, and we reward you.
So when we said, well, it's reward me for my suffering, because I am petrified of heights. So on the day, people are going to think I'm probably praying. I'm going to do a live video. But if I'm looking up, I can guarantee I probably am praying, but it's just because I don't want to look down. So we have an I Donate page. It's just I Donate Laura and Robbie, if you Google it or whatever. And I have to say, the media, everybody has been fantastic. I might just say a quick thank you
to
Donegal Online. Jim McGuinness is a legend. And Rory and the Island shared it yesterday, Greg.
Well done, Rory,
and believe it or not, since he shared it, Greg, there's over €2,000 has come in. So Michael Nocton and Fonsi, I wanted to thank Fonsi. He spoke to Michael Nocton in the Clannery Hotel, and they've actually sponsored us a room for Saturday night in Dublin. So that's very kind of them. The Monty Challenge, all the local businesses, newspapers, radio stations, online media. And honest to God, anyone who has donated or shared. And Greg, just on Jason's school, just in case there's other parents listening, we weren't sure whether to send him to mainstream school or not. And oh my God, it would do your heart so good to see him. The kids there do not see him as any different. They play with him. They laugh with him. They run around in the yard with him. He is a walker for outside in the yard. And they're so good. Like,
that's great
kids
for him.
Don't
great
make
for them
a difference.
Too, yeah. It's good for those kids.
They don't make a difference. They don't see him as a child with the walking problems. So I remember the first day I went to get him at school, all the other kids were running to the parents, and obviously Jason couldn't run. But then if you would see it now, his wee happy head coming for you. So his school are fantastic. They just include him so much.
All right, okay. Remind people how they...
Please, if you don't mind, thank you very much. And just a quick word, I'm in the Defence Forces and my job have been so supportive in Finnair Camp.
Right,
only
before you
for
go,
them.
Brendan, I mentioned Brendan Devaney, yes. Former... he sent a voice message. He's got some advice. Let's see if I can hear what he has to say here.
I hope it's good advice.
Hi, Greg. Yeah, just on the abseil, my advice would be to wear the gloves.
Wear the gloves.
For some reason, it was an option. I remember when I went up and down with the plan... there was some heat in the hands there, so definitely wear the gloves.
So that's the only advice he has for you, wear the gloves.
Okay.
To be honest,
Brendan, thank you.
I don't think you would not have worn the gloves, but anyway. Thanks, Brendan, good man. Sorry, you were mentioning your employer, I think.
Oh, yes, sorry. I'm just a member of the Irish Defence Forces, and in fairness, I'm hoping we're not going to war. But on that note, they've just been absolutely fantastic. They're a brilliant job to work for. You get to see a bit of the world, you get to keep fit, and honest to God, only for them, they've been so good to my family.
Well done.
And also, on the I Donate, it's just Laura and Robbie, I Donate, and from the bottom of our hearts, and from all the people in Donegal, thank you all so much.
Because in supporting you in this, effort, this abseiling, it's to raise money for Rare Ireland. And whilst it might not be the condition that Jason has, they're working with different families with different conditions right across the region.
Yes, and the hope would be, although I doubt it'll come for Jason, is that if there ever was a cure for his rare disease, we might hear first. But because his is so rare, it mightn't happen.
Yeah. And if there's six around the world, what the truth is where's the research going to come from? Because it has to be driven by
profit, right?
And they're going to say, well, what money are we going to make out of six? But listen, maybe there'll be other advances that we have yet to know about. Well done to you. Good luck with it on... good luck. And it's good to see Mount Charles at Croke Park.
Well, I'm going to wear my Donegal jersey too. So if you see somebody falling off the roof, it was definitely me.
And it's controlled chaos. Right?
Yeah, or if you see me getting pushed off, you knew I was just taking my time to let go.
Wear the gloves.
The gloves. Thanks so much, Greg. Thank you.
Maria Rush, what are your headphones like there? Are they too loud? Are they just right?
It's very, very clear, actually. It's lovely.
Good. Okay. Right, now Maria Rush is director of Come From Away. It's by the Letterkenny Musical Society, and it's showing in on Grianon Theatre in Letterkenny from next Tuesday, March 10th, 8 p.m. to Saturday, the 14th of March inclusive.
Yes, indeed.
Okay, right. Now, talk to me about the storyline here.
So the storyline of Come From Away is based on 9/11, and it tells the story of a town called Gander in Newfoundland, just off the coast of Canada. It's a small kind of island where 38 planes landed on the one day in one airport. So the population of the village or the town was about 7,000, about the size of Bunkranna. And suddenly there was about 9,000 people landed overnight. Many of them didn't know what had happened because obviously mobile phones and, you know, social media wasn't really a thing at that point. And this tells the story of the people on the ground who had to get together really, really quickly, dealing with the fear and trauma and everything else that they were dealing with from watching what was happening in New York and in the States, but also had to figure out how to look after 9,000 people in the space of a few hours. So it tells, it's based on real stories, which is one of the most exciting things about this. The story was written by, the people who wrote the story went to Gander on the 10th anniversary of 9/11 and did interviews with a load of the passengers that were had come back and the people who lived there. And then they took stories from that, and some of the characters are real characters. They're based on real people. They have the same names. They have the same story. Others are kind of composites of different people who had similar experiences then put into one character. So it tells about the 5 days in Gander where the come from aways, which is what they called people who were not from the island, the come from aways arrived, and the islanders had to keep themselves composed to try and feed them and look after them and deal with the different religions, the different languages, the different everybody, different ages, all sorts of people landed in this little village. And it was, I can only imagine, mayhem.
Amongst them was one of the Aer Lingus staff sent to Gander to help, Dermot McShane. Dermot, are you there? No, Dermot is in on two phones. I'm not sure he can hear me on either. We'll try Dermot again. Dermot, if you can hear us, say hello. No, just not. We'll go back to him in a moment.
Yeah.
Right, so whose story is this then? So I know you've given it the outline, right? But what part of this was it the people that arrived there, or is it how an island adapts really to this?
It's both. So we have the characters and the actors on the show have to all play at least two, if not more, parts. Mm. So, for example, one of the characters is playing the mayor. Donal, for example, is playing the mayor. But Donal also plays three or four other roles. So in the simple movement of changing a jacket or putting on a hat and changing his accent, he is now a different person. So it tells a story of 12 to 14 of the passengers from different planes. So some of the scenes are in the airplane, some of them are on the bus, and then you have the townspeople then back getting ready for them to arrive. In some scenes you have a mismatch of them, you have a character, like some of them are playing their islander part with the others playing the plane people. But it does, it works in a way that I remember when I first looked at the script thinking, how are we going to do this? Because it's 12 in the script. We have a cast of 16. So we have three who are kind of supporting and doing a lot of the setting up chairs and stuff for us while we're on stage. But the cast is all singing and all moving. So it does tell both stories, the people on the planes and the people on the ground.
Let me try Dermot one more time. Dermot, are you there? No, that's not going to work for us. Okay, no, that's all right. All we can do is try. We'll leave that. So, you know, it also tells a different story about 9/11 because it was a catastrophe of such a scale that it affected us all, but it affected obviously some more directly. So, you know, I had never heard either, to be honest with you, of this amount of people. Like, I never considered, well, where did all of these planes go that were due to go here, there and everywhere when all the skies were closed down? So, you know, it goes to show that these major world events, the ripples are massive.
It was huge. And I think, like, there's 38 planes that are referenced in the show that came to Gander. But I think there was about 250 that were actually rediverted to Canada. So, like, that's a huge amount of people to arrive into a town where, you know, suddenly they realise we have to feed 7,000 more people or we have to find beds. So they changed the school hall. They put mattresses and gym mats down. People were invited into other people's homes to, you know, just come in and have a shower and have a bed. There was one particular story in the show where one lady is expecting her baby and the nursery's ready. So she brings in women who have kids to that house. And it's what's lovely about it is it is based on 9/11. It is about those real stories. But it doesn't at any point show the terror of the actual event. It's referenced and there's parts where we're working very cleverly with lights and stuff to kind of tell the story. But it's telling the story of 9/11 through the humanity of the people that were affected. Mm-hmm. And again, like, we all remember standing watching it. I remember standing in the kitchen with Mum watching the second plane go into the building. And, you know, you think back, if you remember, to the time and the fear and all those things that we felt here at the other side of the Atlantic where we were all perfectly safe. And I spoke to one of my members actually in the gym during the week. She was actually in New York on 9/11. And she was speaking to me about just the general fear, not being able to communicate with people. And that's one of the things that if we could get Dermot on, it would be great, because he was able to tell me about what it was like to actually be in Gander. He was sent out by Aer Lingus to help manage the kind of the project or the operation out there.
Dermot McShane, what was it like? Good morning to you. What was it like sort of landing out there and seeing this sort of massive population of people as opposed imposed on another population of people? What was your role?
My role, I was working for Aer Lingus at the time. So good morning, Greg. Good morning, Marie, and your listeners. I was working for Aer Lingus in a role in what's called the Flight Services Department, where the cabin crew would report in through my offices. And I would have been sent out by Aer Lingus, as, interestingly enough, as a bag man with money. I had a caseload of money, €250,000 in travellers or dollars US and travellers checks and €25,000 cash to pay for various expenses that would have been incurred by our aircraft that had landed in there. And I should probably give you a little bit other information with regard to why Gander and where is Gander. Because Gander is on the extreme east coast of the Northern America, Canada, on the island of Newfoundland. And it was one of the first airports that aircraft would meet coming in across the Atlantic, coming from going westbound. It would have been quite famous in the days of the early jets because it had a big runway, and like Shannon, it was at the end of a or at the start of an Atlantic trip where aircraft were more fuel guzzling than they are today, and they need a place to refuel, and that was why Gander was, and why Shannon would have been developed, the very same thing. So Gander, all these aircraft had been flying on 9/11, just as Marie had been explaining. US airspace was closed down, and the Canadian authorities had to find some place where they could safely take aircraft down, have them parked, and deal with the passengers and crew that were ensuing. So you had 38 wide-bodied aircraft, 6,800 people and passengers and crew landing in a town that had less than 10,000 people. So you can back to answer your question, Greg. I remember we went out 2 days after the event. 9/11 happened on a Tuesday. We were out on the Thursday evening. It was a rescue mission for Aer Lingus, in that we went out to rescue our aircraft, an A330, which had developed a technical snag heading into Gander. So we had engineers out with us from Shannon, who would be to rectify the, it was an electronic instrument failure, and that had to be sorted out before the aircraft could leave Gander. And we had taken another aircraft out with cabin crew, spare cabin crew and pilots to operate the service on to New York for those who wished to go on to New York. It was a New York-bound flight, the I-105 on the day, or to take people back home to Ireland. On the outbound flight, it was kind of a very sad event in that the parents of one of the Irish people who was killed in the North Tower, a lady from Martin called Adele O'Neill, who worked with Cantor Fitzgerald, her parents were on that flight and were going to make their way down to New York. They were actually taken down by Aer Lingus in a private aircraft, for which we had to get special.
We were also in a time too, Dermot, where we have to think of technologically, right? We had mobiles and stuff, but everyone, even let's imagine New Year's Eve, what it used to be like. You know, very, very quickly, the infrastructure back then was overwhelmed. So there would have been communications issues as well.
That's right, Greg. Yeah, there was mobile phones. But when you landed in Canada, your Irish mobile phone or your US mobile phone didn't work. Because remember, we didn't have that exchange, same degree of interchangeability between networks that we have today. So there was quite an amount of confusion and a huge amount of fear among the people. I know that doesn't...
No, we all were at the time. We didn't know what was going to come from this. So when you're talking about a situation where there's no planes in the air, we didn't know what was next. Was this the part of? Was this the start of something bigger, as big as it was? You know, Dermot. And sorry, I must move on. But briefly to ask you, how interested will you be to see how this story is sort of related on stage in this format?
I'm very keen to see it because it's just so interesting. Having been on the ground in Gander, having seen at first hand the behaviour of the people who were initially started off with fear and then with some degree of relief that they're going to have a place to stay overnight and be fed, and then the courtesy and kindness of the people of Gander, the citizens of Gander, to take them out and to barbecues, to organise trips for them, tours for them, bringing them fishing, all of these things. And that's been captured by the creatives who write it into a story and make a musical out of it. And, you know, if you think about what's happening in the world today in the Middle East, so many Irish people are trapped in various cities in the Middle East. Will stories come out of that that will make for 25 years' time, shows, whatever? We don't know.
All right, Dermot.
There isn't the same degree of...
Dermot McShane, thank you very much indeed. And Maria, what Dermot has helped us understand there is that this is real. And it's a production, it's a stage production, it's a musical, but it's all based on real stuff. So just in the last minute, firstly, is there a matinee?
No, not at the minute. Now, if we have demand, we may put on a matinee, but at the
person
minute it's...
Wants
it. Yeah, I know. But
I know what you mean.
Yeah,
yeah, it's critical mass. So just in the last, why should people go to it? What have they got in store?
The show is hilarious. And I know that sounds like it shouldn't be, but it is so, so funny. And one of the main themes in the show is how we, as humans, we tend to use humour to get through trauma. But it's not funny in the sense that it becomes it takes away from the grief and the fear. All those emotions are real. Like the character of Hannah is waiting by the phone for the news of her son, who's a firefighter. You have the Claude as mayor. You've got a captain, Beverly. You've got different school teachers, all the different people in the town who suddenly have to step up and keep their calm. And they do. So there's a real sense of humanity. It's very, very funny. The music is absolutely beautiful. It's a real kind of mixture of Irish, Celtic, you know, folk and rock music, because obviously there's such connections with Donegal and Newfoundland. The cast, I am so proud of them. They're amazing. We have 16 on the stage. We have a crew of about 10 of us who are, you know, directing and producing and choreography and chairography and creating planes in the blink of an eye. And
yeah, well, listen, who've been to your shows know that Letterkenny Musical Society aren't going to leave anything on the table.
It's all chucked out. And there's no interval in this as well. So anybody who's thinking they'd like to go during the week, but, you know, it might be a late night, it's 90 minutes long. It's very, very quick.
Sort.
The cast are on from start to finish, and it is
brilliant. Absolutely
brilliant.
Well,
so
listen,
we'd love
congratulations.
To see you
there. I think it's great that I don't even know if it's brave, but to do a show where you don't necessarily directly reference the event, there's light and shade and grey, and I think that's a fantastic element to this.
And the 25th anniversary
this
year as well.
And it's the 25th anniversary and the local connections to it. It's astonishing. Yeah. Such was the impact of that event that it touched every community almost in the world. Maria Rush, she's the director of Come From Away, and the Come From Aways were the 7,000 that landed down on this community and ended up really being settled within it for a short number of days. And all of those stories and intricacies are captured in that musical. It's on in Ongreanon Theatre in Letterkenny from Tuesday, March 10th, 8 p.m. until Saturday, 14th of March, inclusive. Thanks, Maria.
Thank you
for listening to the show. We're back tomorrow morning at 9.